Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LeDuc. Nick Offerman and Megan Mullally's Summer of 69 No Apostrophe Tour will be at the Palace in Albany, New York tomorrow night at 8. The PG At Least 13 show displays in song and conversation the couple's lauded comedic chops and their incredible attraction to each other. Megan Mullally is a two-time Emmy Award-winning actress, well known for her work as the boozy and shrill Larious Karen on Will & Grace. She's also a stage actress, having most recently appeared on Broadway in Terrence McNally's It's Only a Play. Nick Offerman grumbled into celebrity as the multi-layered feminist, libertarian, lover of meat and privacy, Ron Swanson, on Parks and Recreation.
Hello again. I'm Ron Swanson, and I am still taking your calls, hopefully about tonight's gala. You're on the air.
Hi, what's wrong with Joan?
She has a bad hangover, which she is pretending is allergies.
Is she gonna be okay?
Wouldn't know. Never been hungover. After I've had too much whiskey, I cook myself a large flank steak, pan-fried in salted butter. I eat that, put on a pair of wet socks, and go to sleep.
That works?
It does. Please call now if you have questions about tonight's gala or one of my other interests, woodworking, novels about tall ships, meat, that sort of thing.
Offerman is also a stage actor, author, woodworker, and writer, and he joins us now. Nick Offerman, welcome to the Roundtable.
Thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely, my pleasure. We are excited to have you and Megan Mullally in Albany for Summer of 69, No Apostrophe, at the Palace Theater. Where did the idea for this show and this tour come from?
Well, we were kind of touring separately. I became a humorist in recent years, and Megan has a great band called Nancy and Beth, and on occasion we would get to dip my chocolate into her peanut butter, as it were, and I would open for them or they would open for me, and that was a much happier life. So we said, hey, let's come up with a show we can do together. And that's where Summer of 69, No Apostrophe, was born.
How did you two work on building the show? How did you come up with the concept and put it all together?
Over the years, there have been some instances in which the media kind of really makes a big deal out of our marriage in a way that we always found humorous. Apparently, just by not getting divorced, we are an incredible married couple in Hollywood. And so, you know, to have that be some, you know, glorified in any way struck us as funny. And so we thought we would just take that to the furthest degree and say, this is the greatest love story ever told. And it was fun and easy, writing songs about our superpowers of lovemaking.
Did you write the songs together or separately?
So some of each. I'm stronger at writing lyrics. Megan writes all the tunes. She's like a jukebox. You can hand her 30 names out of the phone book, and she'll hand you back a hit pop song. But she also writes lyrics. So it's a whole mishmash. And it shows. You know, there are songs of every style. Some of them are wonderfully filthy, and some of them are very sweet.
How long have you been playing guitar?
Well, you would think from hearing me, about 18 months. But I guess my dad got me a guitar when I was in college, so that would be about 25 years I've been playing. But, you know, I've had the good fortune of having a few different passions in my life, namely acting and woodworking. And so my guitar playing didn't reach a level where I felt like I could play it in front of an audience till, I don't know, just 7 or 8 years ago. And I'm still learning as quickly as I can.
To feel better about playing in front of people, did you just practice or did you take lessons?
I've had two or three lessons in my life, and they did serve me very well. But it's mainly a case of just finding time to practice, mm-hmm. as with anything. I used to play the saxophone and a little piano and a little trumpet. And, I have all of those fundamental skills, but without the practice time, I wouldn't dare take it in front of an audience. But touring is a great way to sort of hone those skills. This show has, I think, 10 or 11 songs, and after I, have been on the road for a couple of weeks, I can play them in my sleep.
You have a kind of long-distance ongoing love affair with Jeff Tweedy of Wilco. I had the opportunity to ask him about that last summer, and he just said, you guys just love each other. Does he have any guitar tips for you, or is it a strictly non-guitar-based love affair?
No, we definitely are not afraid to jump into bed with our guitars, Jeff and I. In fact, a couple years ago, I directed a music video for he and his son have a band called Tweedy.
Yep.
It's quite wonderful, and I directed a video for them called Low Key, which was really fun. And for my services, Jeff gave me the Martin Guitars Jeff Tweedy signature model DB double aught, and I promptly burst into tears and said, Jeff, you can't give me a guitar. And he said, well, I get a good deal on these. and so that's actually the guitar I tour with. I have Jeff's axe in my very hands as I try to affect his tutelage upon the audience. And yeah, you know, we recently were playing around with some songs together that I think will be on my audiobook of my new book coming out in October. And just watching him play the guitar is such an incredible education. The clear foundation of which is that he simply, you know, he probably had put in his 10,000 hours of mastery by the time he was 15. And so the absolutely prodigal things that he can do up and down the neck of the guitar are quite inspiring. If you could see them close up, you would fall in love as well.
You mentioned that you have a new book coming out in the fall. What is it about writing books that you like? Why did you add that to your resume?
Well, I love books. They really helped form me as a young artist. I think it was from books that I first learned that anything I could imagine could be true and entertaining, you know. Books like Madeleine L'Engle's Wrinkle in Time series, or The Lord of the Rings, or C.S. Lewis' Chronicles of Narnia. These were all tacit permission to dream up whatever I wanted to. And my imaginings took me to a humorous place, which I still inhabit and will continue to do so. When I had the opportunity to add to the catalog of the library, I jumped at it. I don't know, I feel something more concretely profound about writing a book than any of the other things I do. There's something permanent about a book. It's an artifact. And if you succeed in penning some entertaining or engaging or hopefully inspiring material, that, you know, that will remain, even if all of the hard drives crash and all of the records get melted by a volcano, there's a chance that a book will survive tucked away in somebody's wine cellar. And so throughout the ages, everyone will know my youthful stories of jackassery.
You perform on stage, obviously, as we've been talking about, in comedy shows, in this variety show with Megan, and in plays, with or without your wife. I saw you in Annapurna by Char White off-Broadway in New York City just a couple of summers ago, I guess it was now. Is your preparation for a night's performance different depending on what you're doing, or do you have a kind of routine that you do no matter what you're going to tackle that night?
That's a good question. And thank you for catching us in New York. That was an incredible play by Char White. And I don't know if I'll ever get to do anything on stage that's as satisfying as a ripping good two-hander with my wife. I always said that I had the best seat in the house for her magnificent performance. To answer your question, not really. I mean, the preparation for anything I do is to put in the work. So getting to the theater, whether I'm performing as a humorist or in a play, or getting to work for a TV show or film, those are all kind of the same. Like, I arrive with the confidence that I've done my work, whether it's learning my lines or preparing my songs or what have you. actually preparing. I just kind of do a little bit of stretching and make sure that all the parts of my word-forming apparatus are in order, and then I get out on stage.
You mentioned in book writing, in creating a book, that the permanence is something that you value. In doing a play, you do it once, and then it's gone, and only the people in that audience saw exactly that performance and had exactly that connection. Is that valuable in a different way than the permanence of the book?
Absolutely. I love that sense of magic, that if you weren't there that night, you didn't get the magic. It's not something you can tell somebody about and say, oh my God, you should have seen Laurie Metcalf tearing up this stage. There's no words to describe how electric and brave a performer, somebody like Laurie or Megan Mullally is. You know, seeing her sing in Young Frankenstein on Broadway, if you weren't there, the you know, even the professional recording can't do it justice. And I love in a deep sociological way the value of that for a population to gather together and see these moments of exchange, of a medicinal exchange between performers and the audience. And which is why I always tell people who mistakenly try and record any of it or capture some notion on their phones during a live performance, it's absolutely foolish. I liken it to when you find a beautiful stone at the beach and you put it in your pocket, but by the time you get to your car, it's gone dry and gray and it no longer has the sparkle that caught your eye in the first place. And you're like, why did I ever think I wanted to take this with me? But if you go back to where it's being splashed by the surf, that's what you have to be in the theater to capture.
As you've been out on the road with Summer of 69, no apostrophe, has the show changed? Does it change from night to night?
It does, yeah. I mean, we toured it for a couple months last year, and we're always evolving it. We engineer our tours so that we drive from city to city, which makes it a really fun road trip, just the two of us and our tour manager, who is our poodle Clover. And so, you know, we're breaking down the show every day and saying, this worked, that didn't work. And so for this go-around, we have four or five new songs. We've replaced some songs that we thought were only medium. And yeah, even tonight, like two nights ago, we were in Pittsburgh and we changed the order of some things. We're always tweaking it to try and make it better and better. And we probably will do so until we're done. It's just the nature of what we do.
If you can put into words why you and Megan Mullally work so well together, why do you think that is? How do you think it works, and why does it continue to work?
That's a great question. I mean, well, first and foremost, we really share a weird sense of humor. That was, we met doing a play in 2000 in Los Angeles, and we immediately became, you know, it was a cast of like 24 people, and we immediately recognized in each other that we were the ideal amount of perverse to become great friends. And so from the get-go, we were off to the side making each other laugh. I sort of, as the man in the equation, I think I was quicker to jump on. I believe there's a physical magnetism between us. And then it took me a little while to convince her to see it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I mean, we just feel really lucky when people often say to us, how can you choose to have a job with your spouse? That seems so antithetical. And we say, gosh, we feel bad for you. I think you might have married the wrong person because we just simply get along. And, you know, we're in a relationship like anybody, so there are challenges, and we do occasionally have arguments, but our ability to find compromise within those arguments only strengthens the whole equation. And I don't know, for me, you know, I can't speak for Megan, but getting to perform with a comedy legend who's as good looking as she is and as smart and funny and weird, it's just a dream. I mean, we're on stage together as peers, and half the time in my head, I'm just thinking, you lucky son of a As you get here, look over stage left. That's an incredible star for the ages.
When you work on jigsaw puzzles, which is a hobby of yours, and as you're driving on this road trip, you are listening to audiobooks. How do you choose what books you will listen to?
Megan is the curator of entertainment in our household. She keeps an eye on things. Like, she knows what movies and books and records are coming out. And by now, we've been together 16 years. She very much knows what I like, to the point where we could go to a restaurant and she could order my whole meal off the menu. And then if I were handed the menu, I would pick the exact same things. Like, she's got it down. And so I'm the navigator. I take great pleasure in mapping our route and then sticking to it and rolling with the punches if we run into trouble. And she, meanwhile, curates things like the audiobook selection. For example, we're just finishing up the book Them by John Ronson, who's a great, fascinating British writer, also hilarious. It's so much more my bag than hers because it's about conspiracy theories and the Illuminati and, you know, the supposed Bilderberg group who's secretly running the world affairs and the World Bank. And she put it on, and I said, "Oh, honey, you've done it again." But then she is a voracious consumer of books, mostly fiction, but also nonfiction. So she's also smarter than me. So really, anything she brings to the table, I'm on board with.
I have one more question that's unrelated to anything else we've discussed so far. You were on one episode of my favorite television drama, Deadwood, and I just wanted to ask if that was a memorable experience. I understand the set was very immersive, and David Milch is truly something, and I just wanted to, if you didn't mind sharing your memories of the experience, if you have any with me, I would love that.
I don't mind. I was very mad that I hadn't heard about Deadwood until I went into audition for that episode, which was the second episode ever of the show. So they had made a pilot. I never even heard about David Milch was doing a Western for HBO. I get this audition, and I was, you know, at the time I had a lesser agency, and that was why I've heard about it. And I said, this is all I've ever wanted to do in my whole life is this show, you sons of bitches. Where have you been? And then I said the same thing. I got in front of Milch at the audition, and I said, where the hell have you been? I'm 32 years old. I've been getting ready for you this whole time. And we really hit it off. I got the part. It was a great part. I had such a great time. He was a wonderful coach. And the great documentary director, Davis Guggenheim, who did This Might Get Loud or Inconvenient Truth, mm-hmm. or Waiting for Superman. This, you know, he's like an award-winning documentary maker. He directed, he was still dabbling in directing narrative stuff, so he directed the episode, and then Milch sort of weighed in on a couple things, and it was such a dream come true, you know, as an actor who loves to lose myself in my characters, it was like the most amazing trip to art camp, where they said, okay, here, we'll cover you in mud. We'll add some extensions into your already fulsome hair and beard, and all you have to do is act like you're really drunk and sob. And I was happy as a pig in shit, as they say.
Thank you for that.
As I think Al Swearengen would happily retort.
Indeed. Nick Offerman and Megan Mullally bring Summer of 69, no apostrophe, to the Palace Theater in Albany, New York, 8 p.m. on Thursday. Mr. Offerman, thank you so much for the time. It's been a great pleasure. I really appreciate it.
The pleasure's all mine. Thanks for having me.
Indigo is a tough one to pun with, but when we're apart, it's the mood that I'm in. We get along so well, we could never be compared to Jesus of Nazareth and Pontius Pilate. But if you'll endure the slight of calling me sir, I'll be Peppermint Patty to your Violet.
Nick Offerman and Megan Mullally's Summer of 69 No Apostrophe Tour will be at the Palace in Albany, New York tomorrow night at 8 p.m. For more information, visit palacealbany.com. That link will be posted along with this interview at wamc.org/roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke, and you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.